KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 323. And on this broadcast of Free City Radio, I'm going to be sharing again excerpts as part of a series from the Civil Society Summit on the AI Industry. This was a gathering of union organizers, activists, environmental justice campaigners, indigenous voices, and many others who gathered together in Montreal in May to look critically at the impacts of AI industries on people, on the land, on water, and on our society. These are voices that I think are critical to hear at this moment. This summit was co-convened by the Council of Canadians. On the edition this week, I'm going to be sharing excerpts from a presentation by Cynthia Ku, who is a lawyer that specializes in technology and human rights and has been working in this field for more than a decade. Cynthia's presentation, it was strong, it was quick, but it critically addressed the ways that digital technologies, and particularly AI, impact questions of privacy, free expression, and equality, particularly for marginalized communities. I think that she draws together some important strands of understanding around presenting a critical intersectional critique of the AI reality that we all face. So here is Cynthia Ku.
In the way of history, this is by no means exhaustive, but here are some of maybe the highlight reel of all of the major tech regulation battles that have happened since the 90s in Canada and a little bit with the US, of course. So for instance, you have the crypto wars in the 1990s, which is the government trying to break encryption basically ever since it was invented. And we're going through that right now with Bill C-22. Then you have the net neutrality battles in the early 2000s, which is basically, can the ISP charge you more for accessing certain sites than accessing other sites? And luckily, we won that one in Canada. Sorry, an internet service provider. Thank you. Then copyright, one line for copyright. I know this entire chart could be copyright, but in 2012, that was a landmark because the Supreme Court of Canada issued 5 decisions to do with copyright on the internet. And that was also when the Copyright Modernization Act was passed. So anyway, you get the idea. What I wanted to note is that all of these issues, AI is kind of like all of them in one. So AI, again, we're seeing privacy and encryption, both consumer privacy and constitutional privacy. Copyright, I don't think I need to say more about that. We're seeing differential pricing, not just in our mobile data and internet service now, but at the grocery store, thanks to AI with algorithmic surveillance pricing. Social media content moderation, of course, is coming up with chatbots. Automated decision making, AI field surveillance, like that is also, it's kind of all in one. So you can see that you are here at the bottom where a lot has happened already, but it's cycles. And one of my colleagues calls lawful access the zombie law because it continually comes back no matter how many times you kill it. And that's kind of the case with all of these things. And that's why I think it's really important not to fall into a historical way of approaching AI, where, yes, a lot of it is new, but in a lot of ways that matter most from the perspective of human rights and public interest, it's not new at all. And we've actually been through it multiple times over the decades. This also is not just it. When we're thinking of history, this is just history from the perspective of people who have been steeped in tech regulation and doing this work. But we actually have to take a broader approach to get a more complete picture. The crypto wars, that only went back to the 90s, but everything that matters actually started way before that. So when you think about AI and labor, you can trace that back to Fordism and Taylorism in the early 1900s. If you're thinking about how like the misogyny and sexism that's inherent in a lot of AI tools, you can trace that to the US Comstock Act, which was an obscenity law, but is right now being revived by Republicans to go after abortion rights. Turns out that same year was the creation of the RCMP, so not a great year for human rights. Because that, who was, of course, their origin was to survey indigenous people. But that's still not far enough back, because if you go to the 1800s, you have the start of the Luddite movement, which, of course, are being rehabilitated today, because that goes to, it's not hating on tech for tech's sake, right? It's about resisting the exploitation enabled by tech. And then even that is not enough, because Simone Brown wrote this amazing book called Dark Matters, where she traces biometric surveillance to the transatlantic slave trade in the 16th to 19th century. And that's really where it started, like racism all the way down. When slaves were branded, that was a form of biometric surveillance. And you see that traced all the way to through the U.S. plantations and then to what we see today when Black communities are disproportionately surveyed by police. And then even before then, you have the Panopticon, which, for those who are not familiar, the Panopticon is an architectural thought experiment. By many people think Jeremy Bentham, but I found out from a colleague it was actually Samuel Bentham, his brother, who came up with it, where you have one guard in the middle. So it was originally thought of, the most popular version of it is that it's a prison where you have one guard in the middle, all the prisoners are in their cells surrounding that guard like a donut. And the idea is that the prisoners never know if the guard is looking specifically at them at any given time. Therefore, they act all the time as if they are being watched. So the plot twist is that people think the Panopticon was invented for prison. It was actually invented for labor. That was the original idea of it. And so again, it just goes to show that if you don't understand the originating ideas and the driving forces behind all of this, then your tech advocacy is not going to be complete, because it's all these marginalized groups. It's women, abortion seekers, labor, racialized communities who will not be captured, even though they're the main targets in the first place. Not just kind of like the general public does have to worry, but as one of my former director at Georgetown said, he called it the color of surveillance, right? Like, surveillance doesn't treat everyone differently, and it's going to be the same with AI. So that's the when. In terms of, right, the what, so these are just my personal observations. Other people may disagree. But in terms of what it seems like has been driving a lot of civil society advocacy in tech, and now we see bleeding into AI, is it's very much rooted in that originating cyber-libertarian ideal, I would say started by Jeremy Bentham's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, where they basically declared the internet is a space free from government control. And so it's a utopia. It's a marketplace of ideas where people can do whatever they want. And so you had this term come up of digital rights, which really meant like technology-facilitated human rights. But consistently, you had to ask whose human rights and in what way. Because one thing that I noticed was distinct between the work done in the States and U.S. civil society and here is that the U.S. has the concept of civil rights to kind of match with the idea of civil liberties. But we don't have that here, right? We have the right to equality, which is Section 15 of the Charter. And so it doesn't roll off the tongue as easily to say civil liberties and Section 15, right to equality under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Whereas in the States, they can just say civil liberties and civil rights, and so it's always included. But I think because of that, it's not really been the same here, where oftentimes people will talk about privacy and freedom of expression, but look at, like, next time you see something, count how many times is privacy mentioned, how many times is free expression mentioned, and how many times is equality or equity mentioned, even though, again, I think that's the driving force for a lot of why we care about the impacts of AI in society. So part of that idea, and this is credit to David Galumbia for this idea, is that the government is often set up as the sole threat as opposed to private sector abuse, whether that is corporate employers exploiting workers or a single person engaging in tech-facilitated internet partner violence. And then so the final observation I've had is that complicates and I think has shaped a lot of the history of Canadian tech advocacy is kind of facetiously, if internet platforms are not friend, why are they friend-shaped? And so what I mean by that is that unlike other areas, if you think about environmentalism, for instance, there was never a moment when you thought the mining company was an ally. But that is not the case with tech. At the very beginning, we did think these platforms were on the side of human rights, and that's why there was so much congeniality between human rights advocates and tech companies, and I think some people stuck a little bit too long to that model. That's one of the reasons that we are where we are today. And so I think we're in less danger of that now with the AI companies, but it's something to keep in mind because, again, in the space, there's a lot of holdover of that kind of thinking of being much, much harder on the government than on private companies, which I don't think we should let the government off the hook. I basically think it's like they're both bad guys equally, but it's not one or the other. And so it's to our detriment if we say, oh, the government is the only source of threat, but private companies, you know, it's just innovation and it's the free market and it's just like let users do what they want. But users also have bad judgment and are also misogynistic and racist and white supremacist. So, okay, next slide. Okay, right, so the how and where. The thing I would note in terms of general observations and what that might mean for us when it comes to organizing on AI going forward is that a lot of this advocacy is reactive. It's, oh, the government introduced a bill, we have to fight it. The government launched a proceeding, we need to participate in it. And that really limits what we can do because then it's the government that dictates what we can talk about and devote resources in the first place, and they frame what the problem is, and we have to either accede to it or just hold the line. We never get a chance to advance our positive vision of what the world should look like instead. And so the People's Consultation on AI, and I would say Sidewalk Toronto, I think were the closest that we've gotten, where it was still in response to something, but it was still on our terms. The response is still on our terms. Like with the PCAI, we refused the 30-day deadline, and we gave ourselves a 4-month deadline instead, for example. And then the other thing I would say that was kind of held it back is that people were really siloed. So you had like immigration surveillance on one hand, gender violence on the other, and then kind of generic, I kind of think I was like white dude privacy advocates in another. And you don't have everyone working together in a kind of intersectional coalition, but they do in the States. Like this kind of gathering with people from all a wide range of social justice issues, there's a coalition in the US that has met monthly like this since like 2017 or something. And as far as I know, aside from the Starling Center's event in October, I think this might be the first such thing time we've had in Canada. So I really commend Council of Canadians and Drew and Jana for like pulling everyone together like this because like it's about time. So who's at the table? Too many people haven't been at the table. This is basically the conclusion. So this is just some examples of some really exciting work that's come out in recent years. The last one, unfortunately, is not Canadian. That's from two organizations in the US, but the first three are by people, some of whom are in this room. And I just imagine if this was the table that we had to work with instead of like Mark Zuckerberg and Sam Altman. Like this is the future and should be the future. So I think we have to keep that in mind when we think about who we're working with and who's in the room. And then, so what's at stake? I think part of what everyone here in this room knows what's at stake. I don't think you would be in this room if you didn't. So you know why you're here. But the point I want to add to that is that none of this is new. Like, so this slide was to present work where it was some master's research where I basically broke down the idea of unintended consequences in tech, where if you look closely, most of the time, they knew. Somebody warned them, something warned them, but it was just the person who warned them wasn't deemed worth listening to. And that's how the harms happen. And so I, just as proof of concept, collected all these tweets of people being like, we knew, we told them, who could have known? This was utterly predictable if you had like spoken to a woman or a trans woman at any point in time. And that's, again, the situation we find ourselves in today. So it really does feel like, I mean, power dynamics notwithstanding, that it's ours to lose because we know how things are going to play out. And this, I think, is the first time that we're all in a position to actually break through those silos and work together to form a united front in order to push back against this latest iteration of technology accumulating and concentrating power. And so this is the general conclusion that I wanted to send people off into the next day, the rest of today or the next 2 days and thereafter with. Thank you.
That was a presentation from Cynthia Ku as part of the Civil Society Summit on the AI Industry. I will continue this edition with some excerpts from a discussion of AI's role in media and the arts. And this was a panel discussion. I will include some reflections from Leah Temper, who is the director of the Health and Economic Policy Program of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. We will also hear some reflections from artist Mary Leblanc-Flanagan, who is an independent artist that moderated this panel. So that's the excerpts we will hear from AI's role in media and the arts. I will go into that now.
So you work at a health-focused organization, and you mobilize physicians on environmental issues. And AI is everything right now. But what is the intersection for you right now with AI in your work?
Just to back up a bit, I would say that AI intersects with our work in at least 2 to 3 ways. The first one is the health impacts of AI data centers. And this is from air pollution, of course, if there are gas power data centers, water pollution, noise pollution leading to mental health issues. So there's considerable health impacts. And this is really something that we have, physician groups and committees across the country, and they're working on this, they are speaking to their local counselors, and they're trying to bring attention to those health impacts. And as I said, at CAPE, we've been working for many years to counter disinformation, and the struggle that we are very inspired by and that we take motivation from is that against big tobacco. And this was also a health-led movement that was trying to counter the disinformation and denial campaigns of big tobacco and to really stymie their capacity to spread fake information, allow people to have the information they need to protect their health, and also to limit their political influence. So the tobacco treaty, for example, limits the capacity of any tobacco lobbyists to be present in spaces where it's decided what happens around tobacco. So as I mentioned, we've been working a long time on greenwashing and limiting the false environmental claims that big polluters can make. And that work, I mentioned also that we worked on, limiting fossil fuel advertising generally, so the ads of big polluters. But the information space is so much broader than that. And of course, as we know in social media, the degree of disinformation and bad actors that are online spreading disinformation has exploded. So we've been forced to, our work has also now shifted to seeing to engage with tech policy. My focus was previously mostly on oil and gas industry. And now there's, of course, this big alliance between big tech and big oil. And we have to figure out how to counter that. And climate disinformation is rife. It's been evolving a lot, moving from, denialism to delay. And the one example that we've been using just to illustrate the scale of this issue and AI's impact on it that we've been using is that, and where physicians really have an important role to play, is extreme weather events. So when there's a public health emergency, when there's a wildfire or tornado, flooding, so on, these are moments where it's really, really important for people to get the information they need to protect their lives, to protect their health so they can evacuate. Even, if they're not in the immediate area, they probably need to know about air quality and what protecting themselves looks like for other impacts. And these are the types of moments where there's increasingly and has been historically really super-powered AI disinformation being spread. And we know these are, we're in an attention economy, so engagement is privileged, and it's to the advantage of the tech platforms to really feed in and continue to disseminate this sort of disinformation that is threatening people's lives. So that's sort of one of our entry points, and I maybe we'll talk a bit later about some of the policy responses that we are working on of how to counter that. And just as the last point I would say is that I was recently in Colombia. There was a conference there on transitioning away from fossil fuels. And there was, I would say, very little discussion about what are sort of the cultural drivers that are locking us into the status quo. And so this is, for me personally, I would say one of my biggest concerns about AI is how it really maintains status quo and leads to constraining any sort of systemic change, because it's just, you know, replicating the same system that we're in. And, you know, when we think about changing advertising, which is what are the messages that we're getting about what a good life looks like, what futures are possible, what our public imaginaries are, I'm really interested in that broader question. And I think that is really ties into the whole question of artistic production. How do we break out of our, you know, these locked in, not only locked in technological systems and locked in political systems, but also locked in ways of thinking.
This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. You've heard a series of excerpts from a gathering on AI, a critical gathering. It was called the Civil Society Summit on the AI Industry. That was hosted by Council of Canadians and many other groups. I'm sharing three programs that are aiming to highlight voices from this gathering here on the program. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find the archives for this program at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also podcasts. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I will speak to you soon.